Acts 12, the 44th talk in a series on the Book of Acts, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 4, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
I'm glad I forgot all my notes, so we'll see how this goes. I'm going to start reading with verse 1. Now about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. When he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. When he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church of God. Pause there. If you'll remember from last time in chapter 11, what has just transpired is the prophet sent from Jerusalem to Antioch has predicted a famine that calls upon the people in Antioch to take up a contribution of some kind of material contribution, whether of money or food, and to deliver that to Jerusalem for famine relief to the church that's in Jerusalem. We see them in verse 25 of chapter 12, after having delivered their contribution, returning to Antioch, and they take with them a young man from Jerusalem named John Mark. The reason I mentioned that is because I think it's very clear that Luke intends for us to see that all that happens here in chapter 12 is contemporaneous with Peter and Saul and Barnabas' visit to Jerusalem. So when Saul and Barnabas come to Jerusalem during this time, there's tremendous turmoil happening, an outbreak of very serious and intense persecution. And Saul is a witness to all of this. Saul mentions in Galatians, when he mentions this visit, that he didn't really have a lot of time with them, or you get the impression that he didn't have a lot of time with the leadership here, just enough time to check things out, basically. And I think one of the reasons is they were in hiding most of this time because the persecution was as intense as it was. So Saul and Barnabas have come to Jerusalem, and at this time King Herod laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them, which is a euphemism. He executed at least James. Okay, who are the characters here? The Herod that we're talking about is Herod Agrippa I. I'm sure you don't know the family tree of Herod very well because it is a very complex family tree. It starts with Herod the Great, who we first meet in the Gospel accounts. He's the one who's king over a vast area, over Samaria, Judea, Idumea, Perea, and a bunch of other smaller districts. Beyond what we know of as modern-day Israel today, he had a kingdom that was pretty significant in size. That's Herod the Great. Herod the Great had 10 wives over the course of his lifetime. Most of his wives he killed. He was an incredibly paranoid person. And whenever he got word that one of his wives or one of his children was conspiring against him to try to take his throne away from them, he dealt with it by having them killed. So many of his children did not survive. Most of his wives did not survive. But he's the one who's king, who at the time of Jesus' birth went and killed all the babies in Bethlehem under 2 years old. A ruthless, bloodthirsty man, very cruel man. After his death, his kingdom was divided in three parts. One of his sons, Archelaus, was made the tetrarch of whatever a tetrarch is, just it's less than a king, was made the tetrarch of Samaria and, no, I'm sorry, of Yeah, Samaria, Judea, and Idumea. Jerusalem, north of Jerusalem, south of Jerusalem. Another son, Antipas, was made the tetrarch of Galilee and Perea. Galilee is further north, and Perea is to the east. And then a third son, Philip, Herod Philip, was made the tetrarch of a bunch of other little territories in and around that area. Herod Antipas, the tetrarch of Galilee and Perea, is the one we met a few weeks ago when we left Acts to talk about the trial of Jesus. If you remember the episode where Pilate sends Jesus to Herod to have a consultation with Herod, and Herod is the one that Jesus would simply not talk to. He was just utterly silent, wouldn't perform any miracles for him, wouldn't perform any carnival acts for him, which is what Herod wanted. That's Herod Antipas, the tetrarch of Galilee and Perea. One of the sons of Herod the Great, or actually one of the grandsons of Herod the Great, I should say, is a guy named Agrippa, Herod Agrippa, Herod Agrippa the First, we know him. He went to Rome and was educated in Rome, as many of the Herods were, as a number of them were. He was educated in Rome and was just sort of integrated into the household of the Caesars and the imperial families. He got to be greatly indebted to a lot of the wealthy people in Rome, and eventually had to flee Rome because of his debts, and actually fell out of favor in the imperial family because of his debts. He had to go back to Palestine and kind of hid out in Palestine. His uncle, Herod Antipas, the one that we know from the trial of Jesus, had pity on him and gave him some kind of jobs supervising the markets in Tiberias, the newly built capital of his realm in Galilee. And then eventually they fell out of favor, and he went back to Rome, borrowed a bunch of money to pay off his old debtors to get himself back in favor. But in Rome, he became a friend of the emperor, the soon-to-be emperor Gaius, also known as Caligula. And if you know anything about Caligula, Caligula was about as perverse as you can get, a truly perverse human being. Herod Agrippa was a good friend of Caligula. When Caligula came to power, well, Herod was actually put in prison because he was overheard making a comment that he wishes Tiberius would step aside so that Caligula could become the emperor. And Tiberius overheard that and put him in prison. He was in there for a number of months until Tiberius died. When Tiberius died, Caligula released him from prison and gave him a chain of gold equal to the weights of the chains that had bound him in prison, and proceeded to make him give him Herod Philip's position, his territory in Israel. All those little territories that Herod Philip was tetrarch over, he put him over those territories, but he gave him the title of king. Much to the chagrin of his uncle Herod Antipas, who for a long time had wanted to be king, but was never granted the title king, he remained a tetrarch. And much to the greater chagrin of his wife Herodias, who very much wanted her husband Herod Antipas to be king. So they went in person to Rome to try to appeal to Caesar to give them the title king. Herod Agrippa realizes that they're on their way to Rome and sends some people to basically tell some lies about them to Caligula. So Caligula believes them, takes Antipas' territory away from Antipas and grants it to Herod Agrippa. So Herod Agrippa the First is now the king over everything except Samaria, Judea, and Idumea, which has become in the meantime simply a Roman province ruled by Pontus. When Herod Agrippa happens to be in Rome, when Caligula dies and Claudius is coming to the throne in Rome, and he is helpful to Claudius in securing the throne. So in exchange for his help, Claudius extends his territory and makes him king over Judea, Samaria, and Idumea as well. So Herod Agrippa I is now king over the entire territory that his grandfather Herod the Great had been king over. And he's come into the same position and the same status as his grandfather. That's the Herod that we're talking about. But the thing that's, I think, noteworthy is his pedigree. The Herods were ruthless people to start with, and this particular Herod has been raised in Rome in all of the decadence and perversion.
Well, person, and of course, I should count on them because they're going to take care of me, and I should thank them because if anything good happens, it's because the angels, you know, were
believers in the early church in Jerusalem and put them to death. And one in particular that's mentioned is James. Who is this James? This is not the James who wrote the letter in our New Testament. That was James, the brother of Jesus, or the half-brother of Jesus, however you want to look at it. This is James, the brother of John. If you remember, there were two brothers. John the Apostle, who wrote the Gospel of John, had an older brother, James, who were both one of the, among the 12 disciples. And that James was executed by Herod Agrippa, and noticing that that was pleasing to the Jewish establishment in Jerusalem, that that made some points with them, he decides, well, okay, let's get Peter too. And so he's taken Peter and he's imprisoned him, presumably to eventually execute him. It's during the days of unleavened bread, which were a portion of the Passover celebration, very, very sacred and holy time in the Jewish culture. So he's, instead of putting him to death immediately, he's delaying until after the Passover, at which point he expects to bring him before the people and expects them to want him executed, at which point he will execute him. I think we'll see later that all the believers in Jerusalem expect that's the way that it's going to go down. Peter will be executed. So we see Peter in prison, in chains, in a gated, locked building, with four squads of soldiers, and as I understand it, one of these squads of soldiers had four soldiers each. So we have 16 armed men guarding Peter in this locked, gated prison where Peter is in chains. Okay? As this is going on, verse 5 says, "So Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church of God." I want to come back to that. Remind me if I forget. But I want to come back to what does it mean that prayer for him was being made fervently by the church of God. Then the story goes on. On the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, so we're past Passover, and the next day he's going to basically bring him to be executed, or at least tried and accused in order to be executed. On the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell. And he struck Peter's side and woke him up, saying, "Get up quickly." And his chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and continued to follow, and he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who is also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. When he knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice, because of her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter was standing in front of the gate. They said to her, "You are out of your mind," but she kept insisting that it was so. They kept saying, "It is his angel." But Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison. And he said, report these things to James and the brethren. Then he left and went to another place. Okay, we have this situation where Peter is in chains, guarded with soldiers on either side of him, soldiers guarding all of the gates, apparently at night when they are asleep. And an angel appears, and from all indications, what Luke means by an angel here is actually some kind of creature of God, a different kind of being, who is capable of kind of superhuman things, who manifests himself in this bright shining light in this cell and speaks to Peter and serves as his guide. This angel enters the prison, tells Peter to wake up, the chains fall off of him, the angel tells him to get his clothes on, to go quickly. He begins to proceed to lead him out. The gates open before them, and they just walk straight out of the jail into the streets of Jerusalem, at which point the angel says, bye, and leaves, departs. Peter, it says, comes to himself, that as all of this is transpiring, it's not clear to Peter whether he's in real time or whether this is some kind of vision that he's having. When he comes to, he realizes that he's no longer in the prison chained between two guards. He's out in the city free, and that what has just transpired was not merely a vision, but was a reality. And he realizes for sure now that it was a reality. He knows where Mary, the mother of John Mark, lives, proceeds to the house where they're having a prayer meeting, and then you have this rather bizarre episode where this servant girl hears Peter knocking and asking to come in, is so excited that Peter's free that she goes in and says, Peter's free. They don't believe her. Finally, they let Peter in, recognize who it is, and he explains what happened. He says, tell it to James and all the other brethren. Notice that this doesn't seem to be an official prayer meeting of the church where what Paul calls the pillars of the church are gathered. These are the rank and file believers of the church who apparently spontaneously and a kind of impromptu gathering are praying. It doesn't seem to be some officially sanctioned thing because the important people in the church aren't here. James is not here. James and whoever the other brethren are. Peter simply says, give them the message. Let them know what happened. Now, what are we to make of this? The thing that first comes to mind in dealing with this account is this is the sort of account that if you are at all inclined to be skeptical about the truth, the historicity of these kinds of accounts, you look at an account like this and you go, come on, I mean, this is just unreal. Are you expecting me to believe that this really happened and it really happened this way? This is the stuff of mythology. This is the stuff of legend. This is the stuff that people make up to tell themselves for its entertainment value and its symbolic value and all kinds of stuff. But this is not the way stuff really goes down. And be real about this. Just admit, just fess up that God wouldn't, the real God, the God of the real universe, wouldn't do this. I mean, there are problems. There are things that we need to answer. Namely, if the God of the universe, who said, let there be something when there was nothing and there was something, does that God need Peter to hurry? I mean, do you see the problem? The angel says to him, do it quickly. God's spell is about to wear off. Right? I mean, it's kind of a bizarre sort of thing. The God who's capable of bringing light out of darkness, isn't he capable of instantaneously, in a nanosecond, transporting Peter from being chained between two guards in a prison and have him stand instantaneously in that prayer meeting before the people as they're praying? I mean, is God not capable of doing that? Surely he is. Clearly the God of the Bible is capable of doing that. So, in one way of thinking, we could look at this account and say, this must be fairy tale stuff. This must be folklore, because if I were God with the capabilities that God has, with the ability to do what God does, I wouldn't go through all this you know, silly, messy little process of having him walk there and gates fly open in front of him and have chains fall off, I'd just transmit him instantaneously and be done with it. But there are two things I think we're not taking into account. I find this account very believable for two reasons. First of all, notice what Peter says in verse 11. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." Now he knows for sure that the Lord did it. You know, put yourself in the position of Peter and have God transport you with his, what's it in Star Trek's transporter? With his transporter right into the midst of the prayer meeting. What's Peter supposed to think? Does he know why he's there? Does he know how he's there? Does he know what's transpired? Does he know who's behind it? Did Herod release him after he got conked on the head and got amnesia? And here he is finally waking up, and here he is in the midst of the prayer meeting, and he doesn't know how he got there and why he got there and who's responsible for it. Having gone through the process that he went through, having seen the gates fly open, having seen the chains fall off of his hand, having encountered the angel giving him instructions, and so on, there is no question in Peter's mind that the Lord is behind this. That the Lord that he serves, the Lord that he follows, the Lord that he believes, that Lord is the Lord who's rescuing him from the hand of Peter. And the process is all part of that which makes it clear and manifest and knowable to Peter. He has evidence for it. He has a reason to believe that this was the Lord who delivered him. It's not just his interpretation of what happened. It's not just a plausible way of thinking about what happened. There's tangible data, tangible evidence that he can look to and say, how else do I explain why I used to be in prison and now I'm here, except the Lord did it. The other thing I think we need to keep in mind is a more general point, and that is, whatever the reasons behind it, whatever is going on, one thing that's clear from looking at biblical revelation, and that is, included in the good things that God is doing in the world, included in that good which God is creating, is the process as well as the end result. We can take the question back to the very beginning, and I've often pondered this. I mean, if you were God who had the ability to call light out of darkness and something out of nothing, why would you make this world? It's very clear from biblical revelation that God's intent in the final analysis is the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven. A new heavens, a new earth, no death, no sin, no evil, where righteousness has triumphed over good and evil. That's the end result that the Bible says is in view and has been in view from the very beginning. And yet, God doesn't just create that. God doesn't just speak and bring the kingdom of God into existence out of nothing. Rather, instead, he created a world that was made to fall apart, that had built-in obsolescence, that was not made to endure. He created a world that was subject to evil and sin and death, concretely, dramatically, tangibly subject to evil and death, and then went through a process of redeeming that world and ultimately recreating that world in order to reach the end result that he had in mind from the very beginning. Well, is God stupid, inefficient? You know, what's going on? Or can we believe that the actual process, the actual story, the actual drama of redemption itself is part of the good thing that God is doing in the created order? I think we have to conclude the latter. The only alternative is to see God as basically incompetent and inadequate in some ways. He's an inadequate God. If we're not prepared to go there, if there's something very adequate about who God is as the Creator, then we have to conclude that the process of redemption that we're in, that the whole world is in, that the whole cosmos is in, is a part of the good thing that he's doing. It is in its own right good. It seems to me that Peter's rescue is just a little microcosm of that. God is not merely about end results. God is also about the process involved, that the process has some value, some merit, some significance in its own right. And that's what I think we have to conclude about this thing with Peter. Sure, God could have done it instantaneously and skipped the process, but the process is a part of the good thing that he's doing. We have to keep that in mind with respect to our own lives. You know, we want the end result. We don't want the process. We would rather do without the process so many times. But what we have to remind ourselves is that the God who's into the end result that he has promised us is also, will not give us that end result without the process, because he wants to do the good thing that he wants to do. And the good thing that he wants to do includes the painful, agonizing, not very pleasant process that he takes us through as well. That's part of the good thing. And we will spend all of eternity looking back on the good story that he has told tangibly, dramatically, through the fabric of my life. Okay. Then he comes to the house, where the house of Mary. This Mary, by the way, is probably the Mary that in the Gospels gets called by the rather humble title of the other Mary. It's not Mary the mother of Jesus, and it's not Mary Magdalene, it's the other Mary. But this other Mary happens to be the mother of John Mark. John Mark will play a significant role in this drama later in Acts. Some people have speculated that John Mark is the same one as the young disciple of Jesus who begins to fight the temple guard in Gethsemane as they come out to arrest Jesus. And they grab his cloak, and he runs away, and they pull his cloak off, and he runs away naked. That story only gets told in the Gospel of Mark. And there's reason to believe that John Mark is intimately acquainted with that event, and is actually that man himself. They come to his mother's house, and there's this spontaneous, I think, gathering of people there to pray. Part of the thing that's significant about this event is especially kind of shocking in our day and age, in our culture, is the expectations that become evident. These people do not expect Peter to be released. I mean, put yourself in the shoes of kind of the modern Christian movement. I don't even know what to call it, the charismatic movement, the movement in Christian culture today that expects miracles, that tells you to expect miracles, tells you to have faith, to believe God for all that he's promised and all that you want him to do and so on, that tells you that prayer works and that by praying you'll get what you want, essentially, you'll get what you ask for. That doesn't seem to be the attitude of this group gathered in Mary's home. Because the servant girl comes back and says, Peter's out there. Peter's free. He's knocking on the door. And their response is not, hallelujah. Their response is not, ah, God has answered our prayer. Or, of course, well, what did you expect? Or anything of the sort. Their response is, get out of here. You've lost your mind. You're crazy, you ditzy servant girl. They just have no apparent expectation whatsoever that this could be what's happened. And in fact, when they, you know, their next response is, Luke calls it angel. I suspect that he's using angel in the way that we would use the word ghost. Some kind of spectral representation of the dead Peter. Probably what they're saying is, Herod's already executed him. The reason he's at the door is because he's dead. And what you're seeing is his ghost. That's why he's there. There's just the idea that he's actually been released does not occur to them. And I think that speaks to the nature of their expectations. Their expectations are not the expectations that we in modern Christian culture would impose upon them. What's the content of their prayer? I don't know. I would love to know. It would be very instructive to be able to terrorize the believing community. And they were terrified, I'm sure. And so they were gathered together, focused on their safety, their future, their lives now that were being thrown into turmoil, were being turned upside down. What are they going to do now? And I'm sure that a lot of the prayers were about, what does the imprisonment and impending execution of Peter mean, Lord? What are we to do? Where are we to go from here? But we don't know for sure what the nature of their prayers were. Maybe they were praying for the release of Peter, if it should be the will of God. But they didn't expect it. And well, they shouldn't. Because notice earlier in the chapter, they had been through this just a few days before. Were they not praying for the release of James, the brother of John? I would imagine they were. Why would they have responded any differently to that? And yet, what was the outcome? James was executed. They had every reason to believe that God would allow the execution of Peter to go through just as he had allowed the execution of James to go through. It would be simply wishful thinking in the name of faith to have any kind of confident expectation that Peter would be released. On what basis would they have any sort of confident expectation of that? James was dead. Peter was next. So we don't see a theology at work here which is so prominent in our midst today, in Christian culture today, that says if you just pray and have faith, God will give you what you ask for. That doesn't seem to be their attitude. That doesn't seem to be what's being portrayed here. Now let me go back for a second to the comment that Luke made earlier, before the account of his rescue in verse 5. So Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church of God. I'm struck by that adverb fervently here in that statement. I remember in my early Christian experience, the attitude that I absorbed from my environment was that fervency was a kind of duty, was a kind of mark of authenticity of faith. And as such, we needed to be fervent in our prayers, in our worship, in any sort of manifestation of my spirituality. There needed to be a fervency about it. Now, I don't know where things are at today. I feel a little bit out of touch with the nitty gritty day in and day out of Christian culture today. But so maybe this is outdated. But I can remember praying at a prayer meeting and noticing about myself, other people as well, I mean the whole culture, but noticing about myself how I adopted a different jargon in prayer. And the purpose of the different jargon was to be a mark of my fervency. The telltale phrase was just really. Lord, we just really want you to da-da-da, and we just really want this, and we just really want that. I mean, it's not part of our everyday street language. It's not part of our idiom. It had one and only one purpose, and that is to communicate the fervency of my request. But the thing that was always so striking to me is how manufactured my fervency was, how artificial it was, how merely token it was, how merely outward it was. It wasn't spontaneously arising from any genuine focus of my heart. It was slapped on the outside in the form of a particular jargon that I was adopting. Now, I'm not blaming myself for that, because I don't think that spirituality requires me to be fervent. But I think it speaks to the issue of how easily we can be misled, how easily we can adopt attitudes toward true spirituality that just simply aren't realistic and simply aren't true and simply aren't biblical. What's happening here among these people, I think, is a fervency that is spontaneous. Where does fervency come from? It seems to come from the focus of our concern, the intensity of the focus of our concern. What Luke is trying to communicate by telling us that they were praying fervently is, these people were scared. These people were frightened. These people were absorbed in the question of what's going on and what does it mean about my life. the outcome of what Herod is going to do in the next several days or weeks or months is very directly, personally relevant to everybody in the room. That's where the fervency is coming from. That's where the urgency is coming from, is this is about my future here. This is about my life and a dramatic turn that might happen in my life. You bet I'm interested. You bet I'm concerned. And I think Luke's purpose in telling us that they were praying fervently is not the purpose that I would have had. My purpose in telling you that they were praying fervently is to describe to you how saintly I thought they were, what remarkable believers they were, how remarkably spiritual, how remarkably obedient they were, how remarkably pious they were. They weren't just praying, they were praying fervently. That would be my purpose in saying that. I don't think that's where Luke's coming from. What Luke is saying is they were praying fervently, that is, they all were driven to their knees by the personal relevance of the concern of what's happening here. Many things we pray for, we will not pray for fervently because they're rather remote from us. Lord, we just really want you to heal that person that I don't know, I don't remember their name, and is related to somebody somewhere that somebody mentioned, but I just really want you to heal them. I don't know if just really is the phrase anymore. Maybe it's just like, I just totally want you to heal them. Okay? I don't know what it is now, but whatever it is, whatever the jargon that's taken its place, we're using jargon to try to manufacture and portray a sense of urgency and a sense of intensity and a sense of focus that is not spontaneous. It's not coming from who we are. It's not coming from the concerns of my heart. But it's okay. There are many things that are remote from us because they're remote from us. And they don't really seem all that directly and personally relevant to us. And we're not going to be fervent about them. That's fine. But sometimes we're going to be fervent because they're things that concern us deeply and personally. And I think that's what Luke is just trying to communicate here, is how deeply personal the issue here was. Okay, then let's go on. Verse 18, now when day came, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. I mean, you can imagine how baffling this was. Before I go on, I mean, notice that we in the days of the Matrix and Star Wars and so on have no problem with what happened here. I mean, it's almost as if God sped Peter up into warp speed, and the angel and Peter were operating at warp speed, and so perhaps all of this stuff happened in a nanosecond in the time of the guards. They're just asleep there, still asleep. Peter's out there walking in the street until he's brought back to Earth time, real time. And the next morning, the guards wake up, gates are wide open, the chains are off. Nothing, they haven't heard anything, they haven't felt anything. They're just completely bamboozled by how this whole thing went down. So there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. When Herod had searched for him and had not found him, he examined the guards and ordered that they be led away to execution. Then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. Very interesting response by Herod. I've been embarrassed. I've been frustrated in my designs. Kill the guards. It's so like us as human beings. In some cases, when you have the power of a Herod, it becomes just blatant. It just becomes a blatant cruelty, blatantly arbitrary, a blatantly meaningless, irrelevant act of cruelty just for the sake of cruelty. But the reason it's so exaggerated with Herod is because he's king, because he has the authority, because he has the power to do it. But the nature of the evil in him is just like the evil in us. Somebody has frustrated me, somebody is inconvenient to me. What do I want? Well, what I want is them out of the way. I want them removed. And so, if at all possible, we remove them if they're in the way and they're frustrating to us or embarrassing to us in some way. Isn't that what abortion is all about in our culture? This is an embarrassment to me, an inconvenience to me, a this to me, a that to me. Well, we can put an end to that. Never mind that another creature, another human being, another creation of God has to be smashed and destroyed and torn apart in the process. Hey, it's inconvenient, embarrasses me, or whatever. It's the same cruelty, the same humanity, the same ugliness of human beings at work here. It just becomes pretty dramatic when a guard who is absolutely innocent, who has absolutely no part in it, has no reason in the world why he's blameworthy in any respect, but nonetheless, this is an embarrassment to me, you die. Somebody's got to die, I pick you. Then he goes on, then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. Typically, the ruler of Israel spent most of his time in Caesarea, on the coast, Mediterranean climate, much nicer place to live, away from the troublesome Jews who didn't like him, largely Roman, largely protected in a Roman enclave, and doesn't have to bother with the everyday hassles of governing the people. So Herod is no exception. He spends most of his time in Caesarea. He's there for the Passover, leaves and goes back to Caesarea. Luke tells us what happens, though. Now, he was very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and with one accord, the people of Tyre and Sidon, came to him, and having won over Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they were asking for peace, because their country was fed by the king's country. Judea supplies the food supplies for Tyre and Sidon. They can't really afford to be at enmity with Herod. They need to establish, to be reconciled and establish a peaceful relationship. They maneuver to win over the king's chamberlain. He has influence on Herod, and he arranges for an audience, thank you. An audience with the king. And they were asking for peace because their country was fed by the king's country. On an appointed day, Herod, having put on his royal apparel, took his seat on the rostrum and began delivering an address to them. The people kept crying out, "The voice of a god and not of a man." Now Josephus records this event as well. He puts on his royal apparel, that's true, but this was a royal apparel that Herod had specially made that had, I don't remember now, all kinds of silver fiber or gold fiber in it or something like that. It was luminous. It glittered. It shined brightly. And the people, in seeing these brightly shining garments, they begin flattering him. "Oh, you're not a man. You're a god. And you're speaking like a god, not a man." Of course, not their intentions, their purposes are not very veiled. They're wanting to have peace with the king, and flattery is their strategy for doing that. Immediately, an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and died. Now, Josephus describes this event as well, and he says that some sort of stomach ailment suddenly, some kind of attack to his intestines suddenly occurred, and Herod was immediately struck, was put into bed, and I can't remember if it was 3 or 5 days later, he died. If in reading Luke's account, it may sound like he just was struck and died immediately. Apparently, that's not how it went down. He was struck and died as a consequence of this attack 3 or 5 days later. It's interesting. We've seen the word angel used 3 different ways here in this passage. The first way it was used was to describe an actual being, an actual creature sent by God to lead Peter out of prison. Then we heard the word angel used in the way that we would use ghost, a spectral representation of a human being, a deceased human being. Now the angel of the Lord seems to be nothing more and nothing less than some kind of biological malfunction in Herod's body, some kind of an attack. We could read this as being accomplished instrumentally by an angelic being, but I really don't see any reason to do that, particularly in the light of the way Josephus describes what happened. You remember there's a psalm that's quoted in Hebrews. God makes flames of fire his angels and the winds his messengers. That is, any part of God's creation can be used by God as his messenger, as his servant, as the one sent to accomplish his purposes. And I think that's the way that Luke is using it here. The angel of the Lord is the parasite or whatever it is that has caused this attack and his eventual death. Why is Luke telling us of this event? I think there's two reasons, maybe three reasons here. One is Herod is being judged for the cruelty that he has displayed in the persecution of the church and his whole interaction, the bloodthirsty purge of Christians in Jerusalem. He's connecting those two, I think. Secondly, he's going to go on to talk about the peace that ensued when Herod had died. One of the other things that God is doing is taking Herod out of the way. He wants the early church to continue to expand in its scope and in its influence, and he takes the enemy, the active enemy of that, out of the way so that that can happen. And then thirdly, it is at least striking that of all the things that Herod has done, I mean, he's killed these soldiers arbitrarily, he has killed one apostle, he's imprisoned with the intention of killing another apostle. I mean, he's done a lot of really damnable things here. It's striking that the thing God correlates his death with is something far more subtle than that. Oh, you speak with the voice of a God and not of a man. And we don't know Herod's response, but at the very least, he's enjoying the flattery. He finds the flattery delicious. And it's at that point that God chooses to cause this attack, to cause this fatal attack on himself as a judgment. Herod's basic fundamental problem is the problem of not knowing who he is. Not knowing that he is merely a creature of the living God, that he is merely a human being, that there is no significance to him beyond the significance of any creature. That's at the heart of all of our evil in most respects. The root of all evil is our not recognizing who we really are. God doesn't owe us anything. We are not significant in our own right. We are not important in our own right. We are important only because our Creator has invested us with importance, not because we're anything in and of ourselves. Herod, in losing sight of that, is worthy of judgment, and God strikes him dead on the spot. Okay, I'm sure I forgot some things that were in my notes, but questions, comments?
On the subject of angels, it's interesting that it seems to me that our culture, our Christian culture, modern Christian culture, in quotes, the United States, which thinks of itself as a Christian nation, which is, I think, highly debatable, but seems to have a fascination for angels, and by that they mean beings who look sort of human, but they have superhuman powers. And so you've got movie or TV shows like Touched by an Angel.